Want flexibility? Take yoga. Want flexibility with your health insurance? Check out United Healthcare Insurance Plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer flexible, budget-friendly medical, dental, and vision coverage that may be right for you. More at uh1.com.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads, generally, for most people, are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
This is indeed a sad moment because Jim, my colleague, cannot join us for this podcast. Sadly, he has a bad cold and is confined to his home. So I am here alone doing this podcast. And one thing that strikes me as a little weird is that we're using one medium, podcasting, to recommend that we spend more time with another, book reading. Joseph Luzzi, reading is vital to our democracy.
Think of the first lines of the Divine Comedy. Nel mezzo del cammin di nostra vita mi ritrovai per una selva oscura. In the middle of life's journey, I found myself in a dark wood. All of us, at one point in our lives, will end up in the dark wood. We will all have our crisis moment, and it's not what lands you in the dark wood that defines you, but what you do to get out of it.
Our show is about fixes.
Yeah, how to make the world a better place.
How do we fix it?
How do we fix it?
For the first time in our modern history, America is led by a president who doesn't read. But literature is more important than ever. Our next guest will explain why as we explore the benefits of reading fiction in particular. Joseph Luzzi is a writer and professor of comparative literature at Bard College, and he's kind enough to join us here at our table at How Do We Fix It World Headquarters. Welcome to How Do We Fix It.
Thank you, Richard. It's a pleasure and honor to be here.
So first, the numbers on reading are not good, are they? I mean, fewer Americans are reading now than they were, say, 15, 20 years ago.
Absolutely. You know, according to a recent study cited by the Washington Post, Americans are reading for pleasure 30% today less than they were in 2004.
Wow.
Another study that I saw cited showed that Americans are watching about 3 hours of TV a day compared to 0.26 hours a day of reading.
So they're spending more than 10 times as much passively watching a television screen than actively being involved with a book.
However one interprets the numbers, it's clear that there's an extraordinary shift towards consuming a visual medium for pleasure as opposed to reading.
And I suppose back in the day, we had just 3 major television networks, and then we got cable, and then we got the internet, and now we have social media. So there's a lot of competition for reading books that didn't exist in the past.
I think that's right. I mean, I would like to preface my remarks by saying I want to avoid above all what I call the curmudgeon fallacy. In other words, obviously I, as a professor of comparative literature and an author, have a vested interest in reading, and I'm going to argue that they're good for us in general, good for America in general. It shouldn't be like a, you know, steamed broccoli. You know, in other words, just get the book down, get that Tolstoy down, and you'll feel better.
Well,
the benefits.
How does reading differ from eating your broccoli?
Well, I think people can think of reading as something that brings great pleasure as well as utility. People who want to excel academically must read. So there's no question that if you're in school and you want to do well, there's a utilitarian reason for continuing to read. But when average Americans stop reading for leisure, for pleasure, then I think we have an issue. And how do we address that?
What is the issue? I mean, is it a threat to our democracy?
I think that the ability to think critically, to process different arguments, to understand other people's positions and point of views which arguably are on the wane. And in America, that increasingly gets its news from social media, that is increasingly divided, increasingly has difficulty in seeing the other person's point of view. That's what reading's all about. Reading is seeing the world through someone else's eyes. I think of social media as a mirror. You look into it, and your tastes and interests are reflected back on you. Literature is a prism. You look into it and you're engaged, as Virginia Woolf said, with the mind of someone else.
Something else. When we were doing research for this show, we came across an article in The Guardian about you that was written 3 years ago. How Dante saved my life when I became a widower and a father on the same day. Yes. Could you share that with us?
Sure. In late 2007, my late wife, Catherine Mester, had a car accident, which was fatal, and she was 8.5 months pregnant. 45 minutes before she died, she delivered our daughter, Isabel. But in the space of a couple hours, I was both a widower and a father. And it was, you know, an intense immersion in grief that took me years to get out of. My guide during all that, as I wrote about in a book called In a Dark Wood, what Dante taught me about grief, healing, and the mysteries of love, was how great literature like Dante's Divine Comedy can be a guide to us in our darkest moments.
What did it do in your case that perhaps reading self-help books would not have done?
Think of the first lines of the Divine Comedy. Nel mezzo del cammin di nostra vita mi ritrovai per una selva oscura. In the middle of life's journey, I found myself in a dark wood. Dante's a Christian, but it's not just for Christian or religious people to read. Because what Dante's saying is that all of us, at one point in our lives, will end up in the dark wood. We will all have our crisis moment, and it's not what lands you in the dark wood that defines you, but what you do to get out of it. And for me, who had spent his life studying Dante, teaching literature like the Divine Comedy, I heard his voice for the first time during this moment of crisis, and it was his no-nonsense. He doesn't provide any easy answers, but he shows you how, through the example of his own life, Dante lost everything. He was exiled from Florence when he was 36, spent the last 20 years of his life wandering. Personal defeat of losing the home he loved. But he wrote the Divine Comedy during that time, and that's a record of him coming to terms with his great loss, his beloved city.
Are there universal truths about the human condition that can be learned through reading ancient literature?
You know, the word universal is one that gets some people's back up. And I completely understand that. One person's universal may not be another person's. So I prefer the term enduring. And that's the definition of classical literature. Think of Augustine's Confessions. It was written in the late 300s, like 1600 years ago. But it's really the template for the modern memoir. At its heart, it's an addiction narrative. Augustine is addicted to lust. He's addicted to work and earthly glories. And he has this crisis moment. He's far from God. And halfway through, he hears these magical words, pick it up and read, tole legge. And he picks up the closest book, the Bible, and he randomly reads a passage that changes his life, that allows him to make this break with the things that were holding him back. I think if you pick up most memoirs today, you'll see Augustinian patterns in them. What got me down? What made me struggle, how I got out of it. So that was written in a world completely different from ours. And if you read anything else from that period, most likely won't make much sense to you. The miracle is that a book like that continues to communicate to us today.
What do you say to those who argue that too many of the examples that are cited about our literature are by dead white males?
Well, Augustine was North African, so I think in that particular case, he wouldn't fit the traditional categories. I also completely understand and believe in the need for an expanded canon, literary canon, that we need to hear from a plurality of voices to be as inclusive as possible. But I think that happens. I think that happens naturally and organically because we only elevate to the category of great books the books that make sense to us collectively as a society. So what we're reading today in a literature class where I teach at Bard would be very different from what they were reading 100 years ago. And that's right. That's the way it should be. So I trust in the capacity of readers to create those reading lists which matter to them now.
Coming up, we're going to be looking at some ideas of how we can improve our reading time. I'm speaking with Joseph Lutze, who is a writer and professor of comparative literature at Bard College. Jim is off today, sadly sick, at his manse north of New York City. And we'll be back in just a moment. It's How Do We Fix It?
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Did you know cats tend to hide symptoms of sickness and pain? I learned this the hard way after losing my cat, Gingy. So I created Pretty Litter, a health monitoring litter that helps detect early signs of illness by changing colors, saving you money and potentially your cat's life. Pretty Litter is veterinarian developed, and it's the easiest way to keep tabs on your fur baby's health right at home.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/news ad free. That's amazon.com/news ad free to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
You say that writing is an act of generosity by the writer to the reader. And I think that's lovely. But our producer, Miranda, thinks, no, wait a minute. It's a big egotistical act of expecting people to read what I'm saying.
Yeah, I register that. And with all due respect to Miranda, what I meant to say was it wasn't the writer per se who's necessarily a generous person or not. It's writing as an act of communication. And so think of the years that it can take a writer to produce a small novel. But what I think is really important in the context of this conversation is not writing as an act of generosity, but reading as an act of generosity. Because without the attention and energy of the reader, the words on the page mean nothing.
Are there examples of where, as a result of a book or a series of novels, you changed your mind, you changed your perspective?
I will say when I read Elena Ferrante, for example, I am a scholar of Italian literature and Italian culture. So I'd spent a lot of my life researching that. And I was also from a Southern Italian family, so very connected to that world that they're writing about. I guess I never really understood the depth to which being a woman in that world was until I read the Ferrante novels. I knew what the statistics were. I knew what the challenges were. I'd studied the problems of being a woman in a patriarchal society. But when you get inside the characters' heads, when you see what they have gone through, then it's really so visceral. And it brings it to life in a way that no statistic ever had. So that didn't change my thinking as such, because I knew that women faced challenges. But the degree to which these novels were able to put on the table the struggle for a woman to find love, the struggle for a woman to build a career, and the struggle for a woman to establish a kind of idea of herself in this male-dominated world was astonishing.
What are some ways that we can improve our reading time? This is the self-help part of the show.
Well, you know, I guess I'm glad you asked, because I really do see this as something that my goal when I teach literature and write about it is, I hope to say something interesting about books that gets them, you know, thinking. But ultimately, what I want someone to do is to go read the book. And more than that, I want them to make reading a part of their lives, because I think that the gifts are, I always think of it as the greatest gift you can give someone, because it's a lifelong gift that they can cultivate every day that will change them.
Do you think people should read books every day?
Well, I have what I call the rule of fours to make it easier to read. I think that if you read for 45 minutes a day, 4 days a week, almost like an exercise commitment, it's totally manageable. 45 minutes a day, 4 days a week, commit to it. And then read four books. One, a fun book, mystery, genre, whatever, romance, you name it, your fun go-to book. The second book should be a classic. By that, I mean a book you've always wanted to read. You know, it doesn't have to be fiction. Could be Plato, could be, you know, Toni Morrison, could be Herodotus. You pick just a demanding book that you've heard is something worth reading. And then something contemporary, fiction and nonfiction. That's a nice, well-balanced reader's diet. Fun, classic, contemporary fiction, contemporary nonfiction. Contemporary is important because that's what's going on in the world today. And if you work through that plan, so you have your 45 minutes a day, 4 days a week, your four books, and then the two other things in our rule of four. The third thing is disconnect. By that I mean you can read on your Kindle. Even if you read an audiobook, listen to an audiobook, that's fine. It's all part of the ecology of reading. But you cannot be multitasking. Reading is one thing you cannot do in multitask. So you have to be disconnected. And the last thing is put it in writing. Have a pen or a pencil and a notebook. Take notes in the book. I always tell my students, if you can afford to keep your books, keep them. They're a record of your education and make notes in them. That's how you engage with what you're reading. Create a plan. What are your next four books going to be? If you do those four things, look, research has shown there's a wealth of benefits to reading. They show you sleep better, reduce stress levels. There's all these practical things. I'm not here to sell that. I'm here to sell what I believe is the intrinsic pleasure, joy, and, edification that you get from giving books a chance. That's all I'm saying.
It sounds a bit like the literature equivalent of the four agreements.
Oh, what are those? I don't know those. I need to read that book.
That's the Don Miguel Ruiz book about how I think one of them is don't take it personally.
Okay.
Be impeccable with your word. Don't make assumptions. And always do your best.
Well,
and then years later, he added another one, which I love as a journalist, which is be skeptical.
I think all of those could sort of connect to reading in some way. What I wanted to do with my list is to show that it's not this austere, demanding, pedantic thing. It really is the complete opposite of that. Do a little experiment. Compare the face of someone who's surfed the web for an hour to someone who's read a good book for an hour.
We started this podcast with the observation that Donald Trump doesn't read. If our leaders read more, not just Trump, but others, what would it do you think?
You know, I've had the great fortune of speaking often the last year or so for One Day University on presidents and the books they do read. And I started that research with this open question. Have books shaped the history of the Oval Office? I have been astonished to find how much our greatest presidents read books and how influential books were in some of the most consequential decisions in U.S. history. George Washington was obsessed with this 18th century British play by Joseph Addison about liberty and sacrificing for one's country, Joseph Addison's play Cato. Thomas Jefferson read voraciously. His books formed the collection for the Library of Congress and the University of Virginia Library. And the Declaration of Independence is steeped in Jefferson's knowledge of 18th century political philosophers like Locke and Rousseau, among many others. Abraham Lincoln read Shakespeare intensely, had a profound knowledge of Shakespeare and the moral decisions that Lincoln made during the Civil War, his decision to free the slaves. They were, to a great sense, shaped by his understanding of tragedy in Shakespeare. Lincoln was someone who, to his grave, carried the sense of all the blood that was shed in the name of the ideals he believed in. He believed they were ideals worth dying for, but that didn't change his sense of the tragedy at the heart of all the loss of American life, the sense of tragedy that he got in large part from reading works like Macbeth and Hamlet. So John F. Kennedy, Franklin Delano Roosevelt, so many of our great presidents were great bookworms.
Joseph Lutze, professor of comparative literature at Bard College, thanks for joining us.
Thank you so much. It was a real pleasure. Thank you.
Yeah, pleasure for me too.
Our conversation with Joe Lutze. In a moment, I'll be speaking with Jim, who miraculously is feeling better, about what we discussed with Joe Lutze. Okay, Jim, we've heard from Joe Lutze and some of the books that really changed him and had a big impact on his life. What about you? What books have changed you?
I was so sorry to miss your conversation with Joe Lutze. You'd asked me about this, and I have a hard time narrowing down the list. I'll go through it quickly as I can chronologically. Book number one, my lovely, great aunt gave me a book called Annapurna by the French mountaineer Maurice Herzog when I was probably about 12, one of the all-time great narratives of an epic climb of one of the tallest peaks in the Himalayas for the first time. Even though everybody practically died and got their feet frozen off, it made me want to become a climber.
A glutton for punishment.
It just was the great drama of all of that. And then Rachel Carson's Silent Spring, I also read as a young person, a fantastic work of reportage about the damage that pesticides were doing, especially to bird populations. And that got me really interested in the environmental movement. Today we look back and their book's she goes a little overboard on certain arguments, but the book changed the world. And I see eagles fly by my house usually once or twice a week. They wouldn't be here if we hadn't banned DDT back in the 60s, thanks to
her. In front of my house I see egrets and they were also nearly extinct.
Yeah. In college I'm not going to pick one book, but I read a lot of Friedrich Nietzsche, the very justifiably controversial philosopher, but it got me deeply inspired into the power of ideas and pure thought. And then finally, a book by Charles C. Mann, who's a fairly recent guest on How Do We Fix It for his most recent book. He wrote a book called 1491 about what North and South America were like just before the first contact with Europeans. And it's one of those books that completely changes your paradigms about how you look at a certain situation. In this case, a lot of our images of Native Americans as being these very kind of primitive hunter-gatherers, it turns out it's quite wrong. They were far more advanced, far more agricultural than we tend to think. So here's my takeaway from this episode.
Well, wait a minute. Ask me what my books are. Come on.
You got to talk the whole show. So, Richard, what are your books?
Okay, I'll keep mine shorter. For me, the books that have changed me are books mostly by people who are not like me, and I find they're usually novels. One recent example is Americana by the Nigerian-American writer Chimamanda Ngozi Adichie. I probably have mangled that pronunciation, but her book is about the migrant experience, and I've been reading a bunch of different novels about migrants that I found really fascinating. And again, coming to that argument that Joe Lutze put of putting yourself in another person's shoes. When I was a kid, I read Chaucer's Canterbury Tales and realized that hundreds of years ago, dirty fart jokes and off-color jokes were very much part of life. And that was very comforting to me at a time when I was being told by my teachers to read Shakespeare and other forms of literature.
Yeah. Well, Shakespeare has plenty of dirty jokes as well.
It does, but boy, there's nothing quite like the Canterbury Tales. Bastard Out of Carolina by Dorothy Allison Invisible Man by Ralph Ellison, and then the wonderful West with the Night, which was my first audiobook. And I remember loving it so much, I didn't care if I was in a traffic jam. It's by Beryl Markham, the first woman to fly solo across the Atlantic from Europe to North America.
Yeah, it's a wonderful book. And I completely share his concern about the fall off in reading among younger people. So I think that his suggestions, I mean, it seems pretty easy. I probably do that. But it's wonderful to have it kind of laid out as a plan. You know, imagine how rich your experience in your life will be if you started that as a young person and do that throughout your life.
Thanks, Jim. It's How Do We Fix It? I'm Richard Davies.
And I'm Jim Mays.
And on next week's show, 8 for 18, 8 takeaways from 2018, things that we learned that we want to share with you. That'll be coming up on the next episode of How Do We Fix It? We're a production of Davies Content. We make digital audio for companies and nonprofits. Please check us out at our website, daviescontent.com. Our producer is Miranda Schaefer. And thanks very much for listening.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hey, everyone. Craig Robinson here. I want you to check out the Ways to Win podcast, brought to you by Ford and the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. On Ways to Win, Coach Cal and I will discuss leadership lessons we've learned. We know all about the days spent perfecting your craft outside of the limelight and have knowledge to share about how strength, inspiration, encouragement, and adaptability are the key ingredients to drive toward your dreams. And those same ingredients can be found in the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. So check out my podcast, Ways to Win, and also check out the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. Learn more at Ford.com. Built Ford tough, built Ford proud.